Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have. Hey, everybody, this is Anson Williams. You might remember me from Happy Days. Well, I am very, very proud to have been on Audrey Russo's Real Talk. What a great show. What a great lady. What a great time.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. Why did a ring of senior Washington officials go rogue to derail the election and the presidency of Donald Trump? What is it that motivated these anti-Trump conspirators from inside and around the Obama administration and Clinton networks to depart so drastically from politics as usual to participate in a seditious effort to overturn an election? Well, the new book, The Red Thread, asks and answers these questions and more. And we're going to discuss this with my next guest. For my new listeners, Diana West is a former nationally syndicated conservative American columnist whose blog is one of Newsmax's 50 best conservative blogs, tackles controversial subjects such as the impact of Islam and the failures of counterinsurgency. Diana has contributed essays and features to numerous periodicals, including The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, and The Washington Post. She has also been a columnist for The Washington Times, Scripps Howard News Service, and United Media. And she can be read at The Daily Caller. Diana is also a popular analyst and contributor on both radio and TV. She is also the author of several best-selling books, including The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. And she's the author of the soon-to-be bestseller, The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Diana West.
Yay! Hi, Audrey. So nice to be back.
Well, it's always great to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is a big day.
We're
talking about the red thread. We've been talking about it for months now, and here it is.
Yeah, exactly. Because you've been sharing your amazing article series on the red thread on the show for some time, but now you've taken it one step further and released a brilliantly researched and very concise and easily comprehensible presentation that completely lays out what this hoax of an investigation actually is and the clear help in understanding it in such a way to assist us to act, well, intelligently. Now, of course, there's been several books out that about the collusion hoax and the soft coup against, but your book takes a different approach, which I love. The ideological roots, or as you put it, ideological drivers. Would you introduce us to this work?
Oh, thank you. I would love to. Yes, there's some fine books that go through, very importantly, the mechanics of the attempted coup against President Trump, the conspirators, how it works, how the FISA court was perverted and subverted in order to trigger this domestic spying operation that we've been learning about, not enough, but learning about how it was done. And my book asks, I think it is the first one to ask this question, why? Why did these officials, as you said, go rogue to derail the election and then the presidency of Trump? This is so abnormal for America because one of the hallmarks of our political system is the peaceful transition of power. When one party is out at a presidential election or at the midterms, the other party waits till next time and comes back 2 years or 4 years later and may take it all back again. I mean, this is how we do things and have been doing things and have been the envy of the world for the stability in which for the way we do things. And here we see 2016 come along and everyone at the top of the government throws out all the rule books, throws out the Constitution, even more importantly, and attacks our election process. This is profound. And what I set out to do, and this is really, I would say December 2017 is when I started being very interested in that fascinating couple, Bruce and Nellie Orr.
Yes.
And back, if you remember in 2017, December, we first heard about them, Bruce Orr being the senior justice official and his wife, Nellie, working at the center of Fusion GPS on the Steele dossier project, the anti-Trump project. And what I did with Nellie Orr, which I could not do or didn't think I could do with the others as easily, was I looked at her publicly available writings because Nellie Orr was a professor. She was a professor of Russian studies at Vassar in the 1990s. And that means that she has a paper trail. She has book reviews, a thesis. She is not the kind of Washington official who is kind of generic and hard to know more about them than their job titles and where they went to school and, you know, some public statements that are usually not very revealing about how they actually think. So I started with Nellie and decided that I found so much and found so much that was disturbing in terms of her own affinities for, believe it or not, and I think we've talked about this, Stalin's Russia. I mean, she sees, it's on the one hand and on the other for her, their paradoxes of, you know, the good things and the bad things. And, you know, I don't know anyone, I've never met anyone who saw anything good in Stalin's Soviet system that killed millions and millions of people and put others in misery and poverty and the gulag. I just haven't met someone who said, on the other hand, and this is essentially what you get from Nellie Orr, who saw, quote, terror and excitement in Stalin's Russia. And I thought, my gosh, if this person is at the core of this campaign, this disinformation campaign to derail President Trump, what else can we find out? We also know Nellie has a CIA affiliation. It has just this week been released by Jeff Carlson, writing at the Epoch Times, that he has actually seen her testimony. We have not had it publicly released yet, but he wrote a piece that established she was a CIA contractor for at least 6 years.
Wow.
So I think of her, did she know John Brennan? We don't know that, although they did appear at a conference as speakers together in 2017. But I see her as the opposite number, for example, of Christopher Steele, who is the former British intelligence officer whose name is on the dossier and who also worked as a Clinton operative for Fusion GPS, as Nellie did, and her husband, in terms of inserting this disinformation into the justice and FBI and FISA court process and the media. My goodness, the media. No one can leave the media out of this in terms of creating this echo chamber, Trump-Russia. So I went on from Nellie. I looked at Christopher Steele. We can talk about him. He, as an intelligence officer, doesn't have much public profile. However, the British press did discover that when he was at Cambridge, he was a very prominent student because he was president of the Cambridge Debating Society, the Cambridge Union, very prestigious post. This would have been in 1986. And He was known and written up actually in a history of the Debating Society, a book written by, I believe, one of Theresa May's advisors, who also is a Cambridge student. He was known as a confirmed socialist.
Wow.
At this time. He also was known for his work with the campaign for nuclear disarmament in Britain, which was a well-known Marxist-oriented group that was all about furthering Soviet policy vis-a-vis NATO and the American and Western European desire to defend NATO from the Soviet Union. For example, CND was against the deployment of new missiles in Europe that you may remember was a huge battle point back in the 80s when Reagan was president. CND would be an information operation trying to separate NATO and America, trying to separate British policy from American policy on these kinds of matters. Well, Christopher Steele had some relationship with CND, yet to be really determined, according to British press. This puts him on the far left of British politics. We don't really see any evidence that he moved. And in his desperation, that's Bruce Orr's word, to see President Trump defeated, it's very interesting because I look at his past, Steele, and this anti-nuke activism in his 20s. And I remember that, well, when President Trump gave his very first foreign policy address, he specifically discussed his plan to expand and revamp our nuclear arsenal, along with the rest of our military defense readiness. Well, it seems like that's the kind of thing that could activate an old anti-nuke confirmed socialist like Christopher Steele. And indeed, it is after that speech that we see Christopher Steele popping up as a member of the Fusion GPS Clinton DNC operation. So did that inspire him? Is that what he's really about? I don't know, but it's interesting in terms of the timeline and the political context. One other thing about Steele to remember is this confirmed socialist in the 1980s, Soviet Union is still going strong, was hired right out of school, very shortly after graduation, by British intelligence and sent where? To Moscow.
Wow.
I mean, the whole thing looks bad right from the start in terms of who are these people?
What's puzzling about that is, did they not know about his background or his perspective, his ideology?
It's hard to imagine, given that he was a public figure. You know, he wasn't just an anonymous student, the way most students go through college. They don't have the kind of high profile that a president of the Cambridge Union would have. For example, one thing I also learned in reading about Christopher Steele was that as president of the Cambridge Union, he extended the first invitation ever to a representative of the PLO to come speak.
Wow.
Now, this was something because you say, wow, and you're right, because, of course, in 1986, there was no movement on the consideration of the PLO as a terrorist organization. We had not yet reached our state of enlightenment of years later where, you know, we're into peace processes, quote unquote, and the rest of it. This was still hard up terrorist organization in the eyes of the United States, Israel, and so on. And Christopher Steele extended that very august platform, opened it to the PLO. He also invited a Knesset member, Julia Cohen, who's very notable to followers of Israeli history, who refused to appear with this PLO representative at that time. So this is how hard left Christopher Steele was. And again, remember what the orientation of this would mean. The PLO was essentially a client in many ways of Soviet projected force in terms of the terror network that was operating at the time, you know, the IRA and Libya and PLO, etc., that very often had connections and assistance from Eastern Bloc countries and ultimately Moscow training and all the rest of it. So this is where he starts. And is it where he still is? I mean, we're looking at all these Russian sources. We're looking at this communistic worldview. I mean, what are we really looking at, people? I mean, we have to start kind of understanding, like, who is benefiting. We need to find out more about who's running this thing. We still don't really have a good flowchart on who is directing this. So I hope the red thread will at least get people thinking about this ideological abnormality in American politics, not in politics, inside the government. I mean, these are people who have been, not Christopher Steele, but the other officials who have been swearing to uphold and defend our Constitution. Mm. But can they do that honestly, given their beliefs in a Marxist worldview? I mean, this really is troubling.
Yeah, what I love is that you reveal that the fact that they have, and it's very disturbing to me, socialist, communist, Marxist backgrounds, and strong as well. And then you find people like James Comey. I mean, what is James Comey, the Frankfurt School, which is kind of giving me shivers there, and how does he factor into the whole coup?
Yes, well, let's first remember that it's Comey. I believe Comey is the source of this, I believe, disinformation that Putin wanted Trump and that Putin hated Hillary. This was part of his testimony. I think it may be the original, or at least the official original iteration of that, which I just, for many reasons, which I also lay out, I don't buy. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind. But when we look at James Comey, FBI director, remember, he used to be number two at the Justice Department in the George W. Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So he was the Rod Rosenstein, if you will, of the early 2000s. James Comey, in an interview, told New York Magazine, as he was about to enter the Justice Department, that when he was at William & Mary, he graduated in 1982, he was a communist. And, that's just the way it is. He identified himself as a communist. He said he wasn't really sure what he is now, which is not exactly
a denial.
It's not, and it's not exactly, someone who's had a change of heart and now rejects his past. I find that out of all the people I look at in the red thread, I think Comey's red thread is the strongest and clearest, because as a student at William & Mary, when he considered himself to be a communist, and as a former FBI director, former deputy attorney general, and author of a memoir in 2018, he has been consistent in describing Reinhold Niebuhr as his supreme influence on his thinking. Now, I didn't really know much, if anything, about Reinhold Niebuhr before I started doing this research. So don't feel bad if you don't. However, and I don't think a lot of the people who throw his name around really know much about him either. It's sort of like intellectual garnish and a certain kind of pundits, columnists, like David Brooks or somebody will throw him around. Or Barack Obama called Reinhold Niebuhr his favorite philosopher, for example. He's Comey's as well. Comey used the handle Reinhold Niebuhr on Twitter when he used to be on Twitter in incognito. He describes him as his supreme influence. He cites two books. This again, 2018, two books Niebuhr wrote in the period in the 1930s to say 1940 when Niebuhr was himself a militant member of the Socialist Party of the United States. Someone who had actually spoken publicly about the need to overthrow the government, the social order. He was someone who was very enamored with the Soviet Revolution. Indeed, he was one of the chief lobbyists who gathered, I think it was 800 signatures from college professors and presented them to President-elect Roosevelt in 1933, calling for the United States to normalize relations with the Soviet regime. We've talked about this. This is a big point of fall for me in American betrayal, this moment of recognition of the Bolshevik regime, which at that moment was trying to undermine our government, and then this very important recognition actually just validated and enabled further erosion and infiltration of our own government by communist believers and also Soviet agents in disguise under the Roosevelt administration. Well, Niebuhr was someone who was very important in making that happen, very influential. This is the chief influence on our FBI director. And Niebuhr goes on to join numerous communist front groups that had been identified by the Attorney General during the Roosevelt years as being communist front groups. And this is nothing I'm pulling out of a hat. This was the real deal. These groups were investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And indeed, Niebuhr comes up to very fascinating discussions by some of the investigators at the time for what they called his Marxian war ethics. I mean, this is someone who's very recognized for this point of view, calling for essentially a very amoral, ends justify the means, Marxist kind of seizure of power to for out of, quote, love, which essentially was redistribution of the wealth. I mean, these are all code words, right?
Right.
Well, this is the man that Comey wrote his college paper on, comparing him to Jerry Falwell, whom he doesn't care for at all. Jerry Falwell at this time, very important for trying to bring a Christian Christian-based morality into world affairs. Niebuhr essentially writing that you should have no Christian morality in world affairs, that they should be literally separate. And some of the quotations from Comey's paper are just chilling. He talks about the Christian in politics having essentially divorcing his morality from his political actions. So it's chilling when you think about someone like that not just going into, I don't know, insurance or writing books or politics. Say politics.
Yeah.
No, he is someone who is literally carrying out the law enforcement, the federal law enforcement of our country at the Justice Department, and then is in charge of our federal police force as FBI director. Mm-hmm. So this is a very frightening thing, particularly when you see that this is essentially unknown to the public. Who knows this crazy stuff? For example, he would write a certain political action, maybe evil, but not necessarily immoral, given the circumstances.
Wow.
I mean, think about that. Something can be evil,
yeah,
but not immoral, according to James Comey. And you realize this ends justify the means philosophy,
yes,
that he is in you know, kind of enshrined in Niebuhr's writings and really taken to heart by Comey, is exactly the person who can do what he do in the Clinton server investigation or any number of his own public acts that seem completely divorced from law and the Constitution.
Yeah. You know, can you tell us what are Kremlin information operations and if they're real or is this a myth?
Well, this is something that's a very important point to bring out. And indeed, the first quotation in the book is from Whitaker Chambers, who makes this very, very important point that has essentially been lost to us in our study of these matters. Whitaker Chambers wrote in Witness, I would just like to read this sentence, "That power to influence policy has always been the ultimate purpose of the Communist Party's infiltration. It was much more dangerous and, as events have proved, much more difficult to detect than espionage, which beside it is trivial, though the two go hand in hand." Now, what he's talking about there is essentially Kremlin influence operations, this ability to infiltrate a body. It doesn't have to be the government. It can be your school board. It can be your PTA meeting. It can be your church. It can be your theater. Infiltrate and essentially co-opt the direction, the message, the agenda, the teaching toward a communist end. And what Chambers was telling us was that it's not just about stealing secrets. It's not just about the Rosenberg atomic ring getting the bomb. I mean, that's important, but I mean, it's sort of a fleeting kind of importance. It's not the existential kind of hijacking whereby your government or your church or your synagogue or your PTA meeting is essentially taken in a covert manner to a communist end. So that's the general answer to your question. Do influence operations continue? Yes, to this day. And I would say that the anti-Trump conspiracy is exactly an influence operation. We're able to see into it because it was so ad hoc. It was so sloppy. It was so outrageous. And because Trump won, if Hillary had won, and you and I have talked about this, we would see none of these ugly pieces and people showing. It all would have been smoothed over and lost to us. But because Trump won and there has been this moment of exposure, we have at least gotten our hands around some of it. And, you know, the question becomes, who's directing it? I don't know. Who's benefiting from this? Well, certainly all of our enemies, including Putin, including China. I mean, who's really pushing this? You know, we don't know all the answers to these questions, but when you add an ideological context, because I think you see a shared ideological belief that is anti-constitutional, I would add the adjective that's long been out of use, anti-American, right. You have to start wondering, is it all domestic? Are there foreign actors? I mean, certainly Christopher Steele is foreign. Certainly the Russian sources, whom we don't really know, are foreign. I mean, we see the Australians, we see the British. There's a lot of foreign actors here. Are they cutouts for others? We don't know. You have to start sort of creating your own thought experiments, which essentially the red thread is really my effort to get it going and do it in my own way. So this is more than just the mechanics of a conspiracy. We have to understand why they're doing it, why they didn't just wait till next time. It's a big question. It's a simple question, but it's like the most important question about it. What is really going on?
Yeah. When you were quoting Whitaker Chambers, it reminded me of Antonio Gramsci.
Yes. Yes. There, well, that's a very good reminder. And I would like to add, you know, the cultural Marxism that he is famous for is the idea of using the culture when you can't succeed with a revolution, that you essentially undermine the culture. This is something Lenin too believed in, and Marx himself was all about undermining the family, for example. So this has long roots in the communist movement. I forgot to mention, Comey actually does have a Frankfurt School connection if you're trying to draw a thread of continuity, and it's this. Comey studied under a man named Robert Livingston at William & Mary and wrote this paper about Reinhold Niebuhr and Falwell, The Christian in Politics, I believe is the title. Robert Livingston, this was the 1980s. In the 1950s, Robert Livingston was a student at Union Theological Seminary in New York under Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich, who was had been a refugee from Nazi Germany, who was an associate of the Frankfurt School, someone who taught about the importance of essentially imbuing Christianity with Marxist ideas in order to revive it. This is a really important red thread, a sort of an intellectual chain of custody, in a way, from the Frankfurt School, Tillich and Niebuhr, to Livingston, to Comey, to, congratulations, the American people. I mean, this is no joke. This is a Frankfurt School product. Conservatives often bemoan the Frankfurt School, which, you know, and rightly so, but look at it weaponized. Here we see the teachings creating in just a couple generations a James Comey, a covert actor, bringing this incredibly un-American anti-constitutional ideology into the Justice Department and the FBI. Oh, it's terrifying, but it's real. It's not a figment, and it's really important. If we just look over at Hillary Clinton, older than Comey, but not that much older, she is also influenced by Tillich. When you go back to her youth group at her, I believe, Methodist church growing up, her youth, and this is in the red thread too, her youth pastor by the name of Jones was someone who was bringing in Tillich as readings to young teenage Hillary Clinton.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, these threads interconnect, and this is important. So what would that have been, 1960s, I'm guessing? You know, Comey, I guess, is considerably younger, but we're seeing the same Marxist influences, the same Frankfurt School influences, and of course Hillary would go on to study Alinsky. So this is something we cannot ignore, but we've sort of been trained not to examine or think about this. And this is also part of our, you know, demise, because when you are trained not to think about the things that are trying to kill you, you can't defend yourself.
Exactly. Well, we have the death of critical thinking in the school system today, unfortunately. You know, some people think the Communist Party might be dead, but what does the Communist Party have to do, if anything, with the coup attempt?
Well, I think it has a lot to do when you look at, for example, the behavior of a Reinhold Niebuhr trying to recognize the Soviet regime. He was not in the Communist Party, he was Socialist Party, but he was also working with a man named Musty, who was a very famous militant communist, whose party at the time was actually considered more radical than the Communist Party of the United States. There was another man that I talk about who, again, trying to build this multi-generational chain coming down to the present, named Frena. He was somebody named Louis C. Frena. He was an immigrant who was an original founder of the American Communist Party, who became a professor himself, of course. Mm-hmm. And we find him at Antioch College. And this one is a little bit of a convoluted thread, but I think very interesting. You have Freyna teaching in the 1940s, a man named Hubert Marshall and his wife, who went on to become very important at Stanford. And in the 1980s, you see a Harvard, soon to be, but at this point a student, being awarded a Rhodes Scholarship from Stanford, and Marshall himself was very important on that committee, Marshall and his wife. His wife had studied under Freyna. Marshall may have himself. They all of these people, Musty, Freyna, Marshall, were very active in trying to shut down the House Un-American Activities Committee, which essentially were the eyes and ears of the people looking at these behaviors and actions, these un-American activities, and this propaganda that had entered our country. They were all about stopping our understanding. Then you find this student who had become the Rhodes Scholar and his brother now making headlines in the anti-Trump conspiracy time. The brother is David Kramer, the boy who went on to be the Rhodes Scholar and the director of Harvard Cold War Studies is Mark Kramer.
Wow.
It's kind of like, well, you know, it's kind of just like a generational odyssey where you see this. And I was very drawn to that because Mark Kramer was part of the what I call the cabal that came after American Betrayal. And you mentioned earlier, your kickoff question had to do with, is there such a thing as a Kremlin influence operation? Well, Mark Kramer, the director of Cold War Studies at Harvard, wrote a piece last year in the Washington Post basically saying, no, it's a figment of our imagination. And as an example, he pointed to American Betrayal as sort of a perpetrator of this mythology.
Wow.
So then when I saw David Kramer pop up as an important player in what is very much an influence operation with Russian connections, naturally I was interested. That's when I started to look at this connection, which becomes very fascinating. This thread becomes very interesting because David Kramer is a very prominent participant in the anti-Trump conspiracy with connections to Christopher Steele, the media. John McCain was a longtime boss of his, you know, very important person here. And it turns out that his brother, Mark Kramer, director of Cold War Studies, is someone who was actually, as recently as last spring, was talking about how there was no such thing as influence operations, which was very interesting to me because we're living through one. And also in that Washington Post piece, Mark Kramer used as an example of the so-called mythology of influence operations, American Betrayal. So
Isn't it typical of Moscow to deny that? That's ridiculous.
Yes.
You're being foolish. There's no.
Yes.
It's
very typical. And in fact, I'm currently reading Vladimir Bukovsky's forthcoming book, Judgment in Moscow. And this was exactly what happened to him in terms of when he went to Moscow after the seeming dissolution of the Soviet Union and attempted to bring out the history of influence operations by opening these archives and literally all of these former intelligence officers from the Soviet era started telling him there was really no such thing. So yes, it's very similar.
Oh my gosh. Listeners, there is so much more that's packed in to a concise research is just brilliant. So Diana, where can the listeners follow and support your brilliant work and purchase your books, including The Red Thread?
Yes, well, thank you. DianaWest.net is the website, and there are links to the books, which The Red Thread is for sale as a Kindle and a paperback at Amazon, as well as of last night, as an audiobook that I narrated.
Wow.
And it just came out, and it's available at Amazon, Audible.com, and iTunes. So
all
the links are there.
Get all three. Okay. I'm one that likes to get, as we were saying off air, I love to get not only the book, but the Kindle. So I have it here or there, and I like to have a book in my hand to read. But the audio you can listen to anywhere. So I highly recommend, I couldn't recommend it more. And it will be such an eye-opener, literally blow your mind, the information that Diana has discovered and is revealing for everyone. Thanks so much, Diana, for sharing this and for doing this incredibly difficult but so beneficial work for everyone. I will, of course, have those links in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the On Air button, and right under the show description, you'll find all the links and information, especially to take you directly to purchase the book. Again, thank you, Diana, for sharing this. It's an incredible work, and I highly, again, recommend listeners grab it. Grab it now. And you know what? Hey, it's never too early to shop for the holidays. So grab it, tuck it away, and it's done. We look forward
especially the 4th of July.
Well, it couldn't be better for the 4th of July. It's so apropos. We look forward to your return to the show. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It was a pleasure.